Welcome to the Radio 191 FM podcast.
Now joined by Dr. Nick Green from the University of Otago. We're talking about the origins of life. Nick's giving a talk about the origins of life tomorrow at Umbrellos around 5:15, I believe. 5:30, sorry, which is going to be really, really fascinating. And we thought we'd get a bit of a glimpse into that chat here. So good morning, Mr. Nick Green. How are you doing?
Morning, Zach. Yeah, great. Thanks very much for having me.
Of course. How's your morning? Is it pretty good? You told me you went on a 4km swim yesterday, so you must be pretty tired.
That's right, yeah. I was in Queenstown on the weekend. My girlfriend and I were doing this big outdoor swim. But yeah, made it through, and yeah, it's good. Good exercise, keeps your mind sharp, so a bit weary, but totally. Here we are.
The depth of the lake, Wakatipu, never scared you at all? You're all pretty good with
that? No, you stay pretty close to the shore, so it's all good.
Oh, that's good, because I'm terrified of any kind of massive open body of water. I would not do well, so kapai for doing that. You know, the origins of life, I imagine, is such a philosophical question in science.
Yep.
One of the more philosophical questions, as opposed to, like, studying the sedimentary layer, although that poses philosophical questions in and of its own. Not that there's a hierarchy here, but I want to know what, you know, how divided, I guess, is the field on the origins of life?
Yeah, it's a good question, a bit of a loaded question as well. Mm. So there is a bit of division, and we need a bit of background, I think, to look at this. Sure, and so anyone who's studying the origin of life, it's a difficult problem, right? And that's because if you look around and you look at life as it is now, it's very diverse and very difficult to define. Mm. So a good example is if you take a monkey and a banana, how on earth would you convince someone that these two are actually distant relatives that are part of the same family tree?
Yeah.
And so the answer is you'd have to look at them at the microscopic level, at the chemical level, and you would discover a lot of similarities between them in their fundamental biochemistries. Mm-hmm. And so even though a banana has DNA that tells its proteins to be yellow to make it taste sweet, you know, the monkey's DNA tells its proteins to make it hairy and have eyes and hands and be very different, the DNA, even though it spells out different information, it's made from the same chemical letters. So that's the ATGC of the genetic alphabet. And it's just arranged differently to encode for those things. So that's kind of like having two books that tell very different stories, but they're written in the same language. Mm-hmm. And then again, even though the banana's proteins are yellow and the monkey's are hairy, they're actually made from the same building block. So in the same way, you could have a Lego set, and you could use that Lego set to make either a racing car or a spaceship or something. It's the same building blocks, but a different, you know, functional outcome. Mm-hmm. And so if we continue that comparison, basically we come to four really important classes of molecules. So they are nucleic acids, which are RNA and DNA, which I mentioned, amino acids, which make up the peptides and the proteins. We also have fats and sugars.
Lipids.
And so coming back to your, yes, exactly, lipids. Lipids and fats are kind of the same thing. And so coming back to the question, you know, some scientists specialize in the study of amino acids, others specialize in the study of lipids or fats, others specialize in RNA. And so naturally, if you go to a conference, then, you know, the people studying RNA might stand up and say, hey, we've discovered this amazing property of RNA, so we think it's the most important molecule at the origin of life. Mm-hmm. But someone studying sugars or lipids might equally stand up and say, hang on a second, sugars can do these amazing things that RNA can't. So there's a bit of debate that I think centers mostly on people, what people know and what they're familiar with. Mm-hmm. But having said all of that, there is a mainstream theory as well that is more popular than the others.
Mm-hmm. I want to touch on that mainstream theory in a second, but do you think that kind of highlights, I guess, an idea in science, or like maybe a bias towards, you know, chemistry and physics? Because, I mean, the origins of life involves all three main domains of science. You know, do you think that like you were saying before, people who study amino acids versus RNA or whatever, do you think there's any kind of privileging there?
Definitely, yeah. People, you know, can construct theories out of what they know about, right? So if you're an expert in physics or an expert in chemistry or particular subsets of those, you know, if you come to tackle the problem of origin of life, you deal with what you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people studying the origin of life, like myself, it takes us a lifetime to really kind of broaden our horizons and bring together bits of information from the different theories out there.
Mm-hmm. And then last time I heard, I heard that life kind of began a couple billion years ago as, you know, there were mineral-eating molecules that kind of begin to replicate themselves. Where are we at with current theories on the origin of life? You know, is that kind of on the money?
Yeah, kind of. So a bit of an edit to the timeline. So the Earth formed about 4.5 billion years ago, and evidence seems to suggest that life followed pretty soon after. So generally, we consider life to be about 4 billion years old. There's some reasonably large error bars on that, but about 4 billion years. So yeah, pretty old. The mainstream theory is called the RNA world theory, and so it kind of relates to what you were saying. There are many different interpretations of exactly what the RNA world theory is, but all of these variations have RNA as the central molecule. And to make even the simplest imaginable organism requires biochemical machinery that's really, really complex, like just beyond imagination. So that seems impossible. And so the RNA world theory, the benefit of that is it simplifies the idea of having a really complex organism basically into just one molecule, a complex piece of RNA. So it's a lot easier problem to solve. And that's because RNA is this multifunctional molecule that can store information. It can have that information replicated. It can catalyze chemical reactions. It can basically do everything we think is necessary for life. And so the current state of the field is kind of that, yeah, an RNA molecule might have been that first organism that, as you said, was perhaps able to harvest minerals to generate energy to enable it to replicate and eventually go on to adapt and evolve into more complex organisms.
Now, I don't know if you're familiar with the science communication channel Kurskesagt, in a nutshell.
I don't know that one. Sorry.
So they did an awesome video about microbes living in the crust of the Earth, and in particular, there's one called a Odexviator, which is insane. Great name. I can't really pronounce it at the moment. My brain's destroyed. It's located around 2 kilometers in the Earth's crust. Are things like that, are microbes like that, helpful for identifying the origins of life?
Yeah, yeah, it is a great name. I won't try to pronounce it. I'll leave that one to you. So, yeah, definitely. Modern organisms are all we have, really, in terms of telling us what life is like. So they're important to study. And organisms like that particular one that you mentioned, they live deep within in the earth, deep within groundwater. And so they're particularly useful because they live in environments that we think are probably similar to what the Earth would have been like 4 billion years ago.
Yeah.
So if we study their biochemistry, we can learn a little bit about perhaps what biochemistry in the early Earth environment would have been like. Having said that, though, we do have to keep in mind that even something that seems so primitive that, you know, lives in the bottom of a lake or whatever next to a vent, even though we think of them as very primitive, even those organisms still have benefited from 4 billion years of adaptation and evolution. So it is possible that even though they live in a similar environment to what prevailed on the early Earth, they could actually still have quite a different biochemistry. So it's a guiding inspiration, but we do have to bear in mind it could be leading us down the wrong track.
I think the really cool thing about those bacteria is that they like do consume a lot of minerals. Just straight up minerals, like all different kinds, which I think is a really awesome insight into, I guess, how things began, because there wasn't a lot of food around back in the day. There wasn't much.
Exactly, yeah.
They had to eat what was around them.
Yeah, and the center of the Earth is very different, or the core of the Earth and the mantle of the Earth is very different to the exterior of the Earth. And so material that comes up from that mantle is basically a great chemical fuel for any organism. And it's still, as you say, still is a source of fuel. There are various sources of fuel. Some organisms use sunlight, some use minerals, and then, you know, these peculiar organisms that you mentioned, I think, even use radiation to fuel their energy cycle.
I want to touch on your research. Your research focuses on nucleosides, peptides, and lipids. How does that help figure the big question out?
Yeah, so we're doing our best. So nucleosides, it's a technical word, but they're the building blocks of RNA and DNA. And peptides and proteins are made from amino acids. And so even though I mentioned that RNA is the central molecule in RNA world theories, that goal of having a super simple RNA-based system that's capable of replicating and evolving, that goal is actually made a lot easier by having supporting molecules around, like peptides, lipids, and sugars. The trick, though, is having those molecules interact in ways that we would recognize as biological. So, you know, how do peptides or lipids help an RNA molecule replicate? And I can tell you that, you know, if we just mix together some RNA and some lipids in my lab and put them in a flask, for the most part, they're not really interacting. There's nothing useful happening. Mm. So what we're doing in the lab is testing out what sort of inputs force them to undergo that interaction. And so that input, you know, it could be something like a lightning bolt, it could be a flash of light, or it could be a few drops of an unstable chemical fuel that then can promote some interactions and hopefully lead to biological type behaviors.
Mm. Very, very interesting. So you're kind of just recreating those behaviors in a lab. That's very, very fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. The key is that if you just have the molecules sitting there, they don't interact in a biological way. They don't replicate. They don't communicate. So there has to be some sort of missing input, you know, the spark for Frankenstein's monster or something like that, and we're looking for that.
Classic. You know, this is the field of origins of life touches on there's kind of almost a religious component. I mean, religions exist to explain why we're here. For a lot of people, and I want to touch on the kind of Christian science theory of intelligent design, which states that, you know, humans were intelligently designed, I guess. What's the standing of that in your field?
Yeah, it's certainly a popular sort of theory, and I guess the big problem that people have with the sort of theories that I've talked about so far, you know, in principle, it makes sense that you can have an RNA molecule that can replicate and so forth. And I've maybe made it sound a little bit simple, but in reality, that simplest possible system is still very, very complex. So there's still a big gap to us being able to sort of imagine what that system is. And therefore, when we sort of sketch together what it might look like, there's an appealing argument. People can say, well, that's extraordinarily complex. It involves some aspect of intelligent design. So I can understand why people think that. I don't personally subscribe to that belief myself. And I think there is a sort of forward trajectory from the simple building blocks that we start with. There is an explanation for how they can eventually become very complex and replicating systems. But it does, you know, there are gaps, as I said, and so that's the work of us scientists to fill those gaps and make that transition from simple to complex a plausible one. And once we've done that, then, you know, we don't have to rely on this idea that, oh, this is too complex to just originate by itself, and it requires some sort of intelligent design.
Mm. I want to touch on the idea of transpermia, which is, to my knowledge, you know, life began because there was an... When Earth was being bombarded by asteroids and whatnot back in the day, like 4 billion years ago probably, there were some of those asteroids were carrying, you know, bacteria or parts of organic life that were seeded on Earth. What's the standing of that in the scientific community at the moment, and what do you make of it?
Yeah, so transpermia or panspermia hasn't really gained a lot of traction. So it is a really cool idea. You know, there's some cool movies like that Alien Prometheus movie where there's, like, you know, some intelligent race that seeds the Earth. So it is an appealing sort of philosophical idea. But it just moves the problem somewhere else. So if life didn't originate on Earth, it still originated on some rocky or icy body in space. And so when you think about it, what better environment could there be for life to originate than Earth? You know, Earth is a dynamic environment. It's got all sorts of different conditions that can cater to different types of chemistries. And obviously, life eventually found Earth to be hospitable. So it's hard to think of a better place for life to originate. And then secondly, you know, space is absolutely enormous. And so whilst there's a bit of exchange between neighbors in our solar system, a bit of material, you know, from nearby asteroid belt or Mars occasionally makes its way to Earth, the chances of life originating outside our solar system and then somehow arriving on Earth, you know, makes a needle in a haystack look, you know, much, much, much easier than something arriving on Earth from all that distance.
And if we were seated by somewhere else, why haven't they come back? Or why? What's going on with them? You know, why haven't we heard from them? Where are you, Dad?
We're still waiting.
Still out for milk, aren't they?
I'll be out of a job if they eventually come and let us know.
I think we'll all be out of a job. oh, my gosh. I was going to touch on... Oh, this has been happening all program. I have these great ideas that come to my brain, and then I forget them. It's been an absolute curse for me this morning.
But so I think you wanted to talk about why studying the origin of life is important. Why should we care about that?
I was going to get to that in a second. We'll go to that for a second, and then I might see if I can come back to what I had in my brain. I need to start writing things down. But yeah, why should people care about the origins of life? It seems very, in a scientific sense at least, it seems like it's a very, very kind of rapidly changing environment that, kind of people can't maybe get their head around.
Yeah, well, as you started out our chat, it's a really great philosophical topic, right? And so once we as a civilization get to a certain level of sophistication, I think it's only natural for us to wonder about our origins. And I think we're at a point now where we really do have the scientific means to seriously probe that question. So that's exciting. We have the ability to answer it, so why shouldn't we? Secondly, from a sort of more applied perspective, investigating the origin of life requires us, you know, as we've chatted about, to study biology as it is now, and to really intensely study fundamental properties of molecules that make up living systems. Mm. And so it's not surprising that when we study those molecules, we make discoveries that are interesting in other fields as well. And so probably, you know, the best example of that is the study of RNA molecules in the context of origin of life has led to developments that's enabled us to synthesize, for example, potent anti-cancer medicines.
Mm. That's really fascinating. I didn't know that.
So, you know, there's a link between these biologically relevant molecules and medicine and lots of other fields.
Totally, totally. I remember what I was going to say, and it does more concern, I guess, physics and astronomy. But I think you said before that maybe while it's easy for life to start, I think you said that before, around the 4 billion kind of period, you said it might be easy for life to start, we just don't know how it started. Was that, am I quoting you correctly, or am I
correctly? I might have maybe said that it's probably easier to imagine life starting on Earth than it is anywhere else.
Right.
When we're talking about, yeah.
Well, I was going to say, if it would be easy for life to start in kind of, you know, just a kind of a protobacteria or whatever, kind of just devouring minerals, do you reckon there's maybe a great barrier or a great filter into life developing beyond that for extraterrestrial life if it does exist?
Yeah, that's really fascinating to think about, you know, over the last 4 billion years, all the little chance events that have occurred to sculpt life into what it is now.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the most obvious one is the extinction of the dinosaurs, right? And so some people sort of jokingly have suggested in academic journals, right, that if it weren't for that, then we might have, you know, super intelligent T-Rexes pondering this same question that we have now.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's a whole history of the planet that's led to what we are now. Right up on the level of the origin of life is the origin of intelligence or consciousness. They're sort of equally complex. Obviously, they're linked, but they're somewhat distinct as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so, it's fascinating to think about that. And, I hope we are able to figure that out soon as well.
Yeah, totally. Do you have a favorite mass extinction event?
Favorite mass extinction event? The one that captures everyone's imagination is the giant meteorite that hit, I think, in Mexico 66 million years ago that it, led to the extinction of the dinosaurs and the rise of our ancestors, the mammals. So, we should be thankful for that one.
I reckon. I really like the KT one, which I think happened quite a lot earlier than that, and that led to the rise of the dinosaurs. It was kind of killed like 90% of ocean life and like 70% of life on land or something. It's something ridiculous like that. Huge scale, and we just still have kind of vague ideas of why it might have happened.
So fascinating. And there's really interesting geological evidence of these events as well. I think there's basically, in some parts of the world, there's basically a layer of iridium that came on these, you know, impactors that were so massive they coated the Earth in a tiny layer of iridium that you can still see in the sedimentary record. Pretty amazing stuff.
So awesome, man. I really want to thank you for your time this morning. You've requested Life on Mars by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, which is from the Watchmen TV show soundtrack, I believe.
That's right, yeah.
Such a good show, such an awesome program.
Yep.
Huge program. Were you a fan of the comics as well?
Yeah, so I watched the movie, the Zack Snyder movie, and then sort of that led me to the graphic novel as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the TV series was amazing, and it's just a cool song. and this Trent Reznor cover is pretty cool as well. But obviously, yeah, is there life on Mars? That's something that someone who studies the origin of life also ponders, so I thought it was connected there too.
And it was the first of our Thirst for Knowledge chats with Dr. Nyla Shaush, so big shout-outs to Nyla.
Yep.
Massive shout-outs to Nyla. Yeah. Well, thank you for coming on the program today, Dr. Nick Green. It was fantastic chatting with you. If you'd like to see Nick have a talk about the origins of life, you can go to Umbrellas tomorrow at 5:30 p.m. Have you got a favourite beer at Umbrellas?
It's probably a bit cliched, but yeah, maybe just an orange Ruffy.
Oh,
like
you
that.
Can't go wrong with a Ruffy, though. The Ruffy is the correct choice, my friend. Thank you very much. I hope the chat goes very well, man. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Zach. Thank you, too.
Cheers, man. All right, folks, that was Dr. Nick Green. We're chatting about the origins of life. Here's Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross with Life on Mars coming up very shortly at 10:30. We'll have another edition of Hot Off the Press with critic editor Nina Brown. You're listening to The One. Keep it locked.
This was a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. All of our content lives online at r1.co.nz.